Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your nav, John Lash, speaking again on September 9th. This is nav briefing number 25, follow-up to the preceding one I did this morning, entitled Celestial Anchoring. And this briefing, number 25, is titled Anchors Her Way. So you recall where we left off. I included two images with the previous briefing. One of them is the screenshot from Stellarium for the pre-dawn hours of September 9th, 2012. Venus has fully risen, but it's low on the horizon. Sirius is clearly visible to the southeast with the figure of Orion cartwheeling up into the sky, Jupiter high in the heavens, and higher still, the discrete, vivid, crystalline structure of the seven sisters, or the Pleiades, which are the seven stars visible to the naked eye belonging to an open cluster of about 150 young, bright blue stars. And this Pleiades cluster, perhaps the most famous and most observed and narrated feature of the sky as far as legendary and indigenous lore are concerned, oral lore and the recorded lore in the Greco-Latin repertoire all speak extensively of the Pleiades. This particular open cluster is located on the outer edge of the third galactic limb in which the Earth and planets are navigating. I would point out to you that we know and we observe very carefully the sight line toward the galactic center. When we are able to observe, as we are now, throughout the summer and into the fall, the constellation of the Scorpion and the Archer, it is notable that the Archer rides in the Milky Way, the fore part of the Archer rides in the Milky Way, and aims his arrow toward the Scorpion, who appears to rise out of the Milky Way. And the direction of the galactic center, the direction to the galactic center by sight line is indicated by the aim of the Archer. And the arrow tip of that constellation points to a location just above the stinger of the tail of the Scorpion. So that is the direction of sight toward the galactic center, as viewed from the third galactic limb where the Earth is located. And on the ecliptic, that is 267 degrees of longitude, or roughly 27 degrees of the sign Sagittarius. Now, there, the opposite point to that would be the point where you turn and put the galactic center, or the Pleroma, at your back and look outward from our position in the third galactic limb to the fourth galactic limb, and beyond that to the reaches of intergalactic space. And that could be called the anti-center in regard to the centering sight line at 27 Sagittarius. And obviously, the longitude of that sight line is 27 degrees of Gemini. Where is 27 degrees of Gemini located in the constellations? Well, as you may know by now, it's very close to the tip of the southern horn of the bull. It's also the position of the Crab Nebula. The Crab Nebula lies about 1 degree off the exact sight line outward, looking outward to the outer reaches of intergalactic space. And so that is the direction to look, And that is the direction in which the configuration of pleuromic relay is happening. Why? Because the Pleiades are about 26 degrees offset to the west or east from that outgoing sight line. So the Pleiades are not located exactly in the anti-direction to the pleuromic center, but very close, about 26 degrees off from that exact anti-center. So if you imagine the massive braid of the pleuromic relay device, it proceeds from the core of the galaxy, crosses the first and second galactic limb, reaches the Pleiades on the outer edge of the third galactic limb, winds through the Pleiades, multiplying from a threefold to a 21-fold relay braid, and then distends or emanates toward the Earth itself, and the braid is integrated into the dynamical mesh of the bioelectric magnetic field of the planet, right out to the outer limits of the ionosphere. So pictured as a braid, the device of pleuromic relay comes, say, from behind you, over your shoulder, as you're standing with the back, your back to the galactic center, reaches the Pleiades, which you can view in the morning sky these days, and comes back from the Pleiades to the Earth, into the solar system, in some way also involving the other planets, particularly Jupiter, and in some way, of course, massively involving the Sun, in some way which has yet to be discovered, but I think we may very well be on the verge of that discovery. I don't know about you, but as far as the navigator is concerned, the question of how the Sun factors into pleuromic relay and how the relation between the Earth and the Sun takes on a new direction or a new dynamic due to relay is a great question to live with. I wonder about that. And so far, as you know, I haven't specified anything about the Sun except to say that I'm guessing intuitively that the massive coronal emissions are part of a bleaching process, and that the Sun, in cooperation with the Divine Sophia, is bleaching out the corruptive mold that has gathered in the laboratory petri dish of this planet. And brutal as it may sound, a lot of that mold, or the particular mold that is being bleached away, is carried by the human species, and this mold represents the dead part of the species, the dead, infected, leprous part of human emotional life, and who knows, possibly even our biochemical life. There's a possibility that biochemically the human species has rotted out to the degree where it poses a toxic threat to the rest of the environment. You know, I realize when I say something like that, I come very close to the agenda of the planetary predators and the globalist eugenics program, Agenda 21, etc., etc. I've come very close to the eugenicist platform of the globalists who say that humanity, that carbon is a poison, carbon dioxide is a poison, that we pollute the Earth and that we ought to be exterminated. You know, you have to hand it to those psychotics. They have imagination just like the rest of us, and their imagination is not necessarily entirely inaccurate. Their imagination is sick, it's paranoid, but even a sick, paranoid person can have near-accurate perceptions. And so, you know, those people who themselves are infected with a phobia of life, as I pointed out before, are able to detect in their own sick way that there may be a toxic factor in the human species. But their plan to play God and be the command and control unit that implements depopulation is totally insane and totally unacceptable. And if they really believe in their massive global agenda for depopulation, getting rid of humanity to serve the earth, then the first thing they should do is off themselves, because they're the sickest, moldiest, most leprous specimens walking around on two legs. So I'll have you bear in mind that there's a great lesson here in the way that the NAV's characterization of the mold to be bleached out of the experiment verges closely upon eugenics insanity. But the one ought not to be mistaken for the other. And if you can't tell the difference between the two, then it's a sorry day for you indeed. Now, we're on the matter of the sun and how the sun, which is called in Gnostic myth Sabaoth, is honoring her pact with the earth, and the sun is fulfilling her role as a dynamic factor, a symbiotic factor in reality, in the trimorphic protonoia, or three-planet original dreaming. The sun, the earth, and the moon are the trimorphic protonoia of the original dreaming of the divine Sophia when she was in the galactic pleroma at the core. And so Gnostic myth tells us, of course, the Sophia narrative in 9 episodes tells us that Sabaoth, the intelligence of the sun, made a pact in order to assist the divine Sophia in her planetary adventure. I suspect that we will learn more about this, and we will learn it in more vivid and voracious ways in the second half of correction, now that Relay is operating. Relay is now fully operative as of 2 days, as of 48 hours of the moment that I speak. Regarding this particular solar terrestrial connection, I would point to the daily reports on the YouTube channel called Suspicious Observers. Now, we owe a nod of gratitude to the author of that channel by bringing to our attention the massive anomalies on the induction magnetometer proceeding from the middle of June into July. And as I pointed out, those anomalies can be read as due to the onset of pleromic relay. So it's remarkable that we had, if you will, instrumental evidence, scientific evidence, that something absolutely extraordinary was happening at that time, which he called the 14-hour anomaly. So you can go back to his reports of those days, scan back through his channel and review that marvelous moment when that information became available through the internet. I would just point out 2 things about Suspicious Observers. One is that his coverage of global tectonic events and so forth is valuable and fascinating, and he does often pick up on other events or catastrophes or anomalies happening across the planet that can be quite relevant to our observations in this experiment. I would say, however, that his indications regarding geocentric and heliocentric conjunctions and configurations of planets are more or less extraneous. As a matter of fact, those conjunctions and oppositions of planets on the heliocentric scale mapped with the sun at center, or on the geocentric scale mapped with the earth at center, happen constantly, and there is nothing particularly remarkable about them. I've tracked them over many, many years, and I've come to the conclusion that it is extremely difficult to correlate real-time geophysical events with these planetary alignments. As far as I know, the only consistent evidence extending over some decades that planetary alignments affect earthquakes is shown by the alignments of the Earth and the Sun to Jupiter. Figure it. And of course, these alignments are specifically the oppositions and conjunctions of Jupiter to the Earth. Those planetary alignments do indeed appear to correlate to major tectonic events and major volcanic eruptions even. Otherwise, it's no go. And so most of that information, almost all of that information that he slips into his daily reports is really not relevant to anything at all. You will note, however, on another point, he is concentrating lately on two subjects that I suspect will be of increasing interest in the second half of this experiment. One is the mysterious matter of star water. As I said before, it's actually the alchemist Paracelsus who coined the word star water around 1480. And he coined it in the Latin idiom, and he called it aquaster. He also coined another term, which could be translated as star matter, Eliaster. So there's something connected with the deep alchemy of our planet, the deep alchemical designs and purposes of Sophia, and probably connected also with atmospheric transformations as well as transpeciation, or the transmutation of humanity from Anthropos 10 to Anthropos 11. Probably all of this is deeply connected with this mysterious business of star water, which in turn is linked to noctilucent clouds, which is in turn is linked to the problem of the over-ionization of the atmosphere, which in turn is linked to the question of understanding chemtrails properly and not attributing to them more than they are as coming from human activities. So there's a great, great aggregate of new information and new intel to be discovered here. And that's coming along very soon, and I strongly suspect that in the course of this fall, there'll be some major and amazing discoveries in that area. The other little point that keeps coming up on suspicious observers is his mention of the Earth footprint. Now, the Earth footprint is apparently a place on the Sun, located on the surface of the Sun, where the Sun is, as it were, umbilically connected to the Earth. Now, this is, of course, something that makes your ears perk up if you're living inside the sacred narrative of the mysteries, because we know that a pact was formed and a symbiotic bond was formed between the Sun and the Earth. So there could well exist some kind of umbilical connection. And I don't know what the Earth footprint is exactly, but I noticed that in recent reports on this YouTube channel, he's presenting more and more descriptive material on the Earth footprint and on the particular interactions that occur between the Earth and the Sun, two-way interactions. So I would look forward to more in this vein, and that would be extremely illuminating regarding the question of how the Sun itself would be participating in Sophia's correction. Now, if I might return just briefly to the two illustrations attached to the previous NAB briefing, number 24, Celestial Anchoring. One of them is I can never remember this terminology. A screenshot taken from Stellarium. And this is the morning of September 9th. A bring your attention back to that screenshot. And I would just point out, again, the key things that you need to know what you are observing. You can sit there on your porch or out in a field under a tree, and you can watch Jupiter come up, and you can watch the constellations of the sky that roll over the horizon before dawn without really knowing what you're seeing. The signature of the constellation of the bull is really important. Now, here I might offer you a little bit of terminology that I developed years ago in Santa Fe in the genre of what I called naked eye mythology. That was back in the days when I was occasionally presenting sky viewing tours on the Llano behind my house off La Vereda Avenue. So here are three terms in the jargon of naked eye mythology. All these three terms refer to any constellation, any visible constellation. The first is the composite of the constellation. That means the actual group of stars that compose it. Second is the signature of the constellation. That means what catches your eye as a formation spontaneously presented by the brightest stars in the composite. There may be 30 or 40 stars in the composite of a constellation. I think there are about that many commonly mapped stars in the constellation of the bull. But certain of those stars, because of their position to each other and because of their brightness, present the signature of the composite. And the signature of the bull is a V, with its point upward and to the right. This is viewed from the northern hemisphere. And with the two ends of the V, or feet of the V, pointing downward. And those, the two stars marking the feet of the V, also mark the north and south horns of the bull. Finally, there is the graphics of a constellation, and that is the way that you visualize it by adding the act of imagination to the act of observation. That is to say, by complementing your first attention with your second attention. So if you want to picture the composite of the stars of the bull as a bull, then you can do so. You can also picture it in other ways, by the way. You can picture it, for instance, as a lily. But if you picture it as a bull, then Aldebaran is in the eye of the bull, and the two stars at the extreme points of the V, as I said, are the tips of the horns. So what we see when we're looking at the sky is Jupiter moving in between the horns of the bull, the horns of the dilemma. And Jupiter is, as it were, like one of those acrobatic jumpers in a Minoan fresco, jumping between the horns of the bull. And Jupiter will continue to be in that position for quite a few months because it makes one of its retrograde loops right there. So the position that I observed this morning, September 9th, of Jupiter in alignment with Aldebaran and Elnath, forming the slanted crossbeam of the anchor, will be visible again several months from now when Jupiter retrogrades to that place once again. So we're not only given a chance beginning on September 9th to observe the celestial anchor, but we're given a number of months to observe it. How wonderful is that? I'd also point out that on the screenshot from Stellarium, there is a faint glow around the star marking the southern horn. And that is exactly, or actually, where the position of the crescent moon was this morning. In fact, I have a feeling, from my judgment, that the crescent moon may have actually been occultating the Crab Nebula, or occultating that star which is on the southern horn tip. In any case, it was extremely close to an occultation event. So what I saw was a crescent moon a little bit thinner than the hinge, and the cup or concave face of the moon was aligned exactly toward Jupiter, and the round convex face of the moon was aligned directly toward Venus. So that was the particular spectacle this morning, and that spectacle occurred some 24 hours following the most recent occultation of the moon, of Jupiter by the moon, which occurred at 8:11 hours universal time on Saturday, September 8th. So this is what you're seeing in this screenshot recording a unique moment. And then with my second illustration, you have a very crude, rough sketch done by hand this morning at the navigator's chart table downstairs on the lower terrace. And this sketch shows the celestial anchor with Jupiter at the pivot of the slanting crossbar, the Pleiades at the top of the anchor, where there is usually, as you know, a hoop. There is usually a loop where, of course, the anchor chain or rope is connected. The remaining part of the celestial anchor is configured from five stars. Procyon at the bottom of the anchor shaft, and then Castor and Pollux to one side, Sirius and Mirzam to the other side, forming the actual hooks of the anchor, the parts of the anchor that are intended to hook up in the sand or hook up and fetch up on rocks that are beneath the ship in order to anchor the ship in a particular position or steady it as it pulls itself into a certain position. So there you go. That is the celestial anchor that any of you can go see if you have the opportunity to step out before dawn and look east in a clear sky. And you will have many opportunities to see that in the coming months. Now, in this follow-up briefing to the previous one, I want to cover a couple of points that are raised by the idea of celestial anchoring. First of all, you might ask the question, anyone who's paying attention and still has possession of their faculties might well ask the question, what is the difference between the description of pleromic relay that you gave earlier, John, the braid proceeding from the galactic center out to the Pleiades and then back to the Earth, and the image of the celestial anchor? Well, it's really simple. The braid visualization, the description of the braid, is what you could call a functional or scientific or literal description of how pleromic relay operates. And the graphic visualization of the celestial anchor tells us what the braid accomplishes. It tells us what relay does. So the first visualization shows you how relay works, and the celestial anchor visualization tells you what relay achieves. Namely, it achieves the anchoring of the Earth to the galactic core. That is a concept of galactic alignment and then some. It's not just a concept of a galactic alignment, it's a sophisticated and advance, it's a sophisticated advance on the concept of galactic alignment. So, this is our metaphor in the Gaia navigation experiment. This is our private and privileged and trademarked metaphor, celestial anchoring. And we know what that means. And we are due to learn a lot about what that means. So as we get into the question of what it does mean and what is accomplished and how we can develop a syntax for celestial anchoring, I'd like to return to, for a moment, to my process of visualization over the last week. I explained how at first I didn't see a celestial anchor. I saw rather a kind of whip-style antenna, you know, one of those flexible antennas. Certainly it had the Pleiades mounted at the top of it. And then it seemed to come down and curve around. It seemed to be bent. But it also did have that pivoting crossbar in the upper part of the antenna device. And as I was visualizing that and allowing the visualization, allowing my second attention to say, draw from the actual observation of the sky so that it didn't force any visualization to happen. As I was doing that, which is the standard practice, another factor came into the visualization, which I didn't mention before, but I'll tell you what it is right now, and the meaning of it will be immediately obvious to you. At the moment, around September 3rd or 4th, I guess I would say, when I was picturing the whip antenna, I kept thinking, well, that's odd, but there seems to be some kind of spiral device attached to this whip antenna. There seems to be kind of some kind of spiral associated with it. Now, what is this spiral that I appear to be seeing? I wasn't, get it, you know, get this, folks, get this, me mateys. I wasn't trying to see anything. I was just looking, and I was looking deeper and deeper and more steadily. And at one point, I thought that I saw, or I could picture spontaneously, a kind of spiral that proceeded from the Pleiades and came down to El Nat, which is on the left side as you view the tilting crossbar, and then wound around below Jupiter and came up through Aldebaran, and then wound around again through Jupiter, or maybe back to Elnath, I don't know, and then wound downward and in some way engaged the lower shaft of the whiplash antenna. And I thought, that's really odd. I mean, why am I visualizing this? Well, maybe it's simply because I already have in my imagination the visualization of the visualization of pleuromic relay as it involves a massive braid proceeding from the galactic center. So I thought, well, I guess I'm just seeing the braid. I'm seeing the braid as a kind of spiral winding around and engaging this other structure, whatever this other structure may be, this sort of wambly, tilted antenna-like structure has some kind of braid winding around it. And so I was a bit baffled by that visualization. But then, of course, the moment that I got the total and complete visualization of the celestial anchor, I knew exactly what I had previously been seeing. And so I include, as an attachment to this NAB briefing, a couple of images which can be found on image search if you type in the word anchor. Very typically, anchors have been depicted through the ages with the anchor line. We know that the anchor line is tied to the upper end of the anchor, which would be, in this case, the Pleiades spindle. Well, how perfect is that? I mean, we know that relay comes through the Pleiades spindle, so the Pleiades spindle obviously presents a perfect counterpart to the metal loop at the top of an anchor where the tether or hawser is attached. But it gets better. If you go and look at some of the images that come up when you search anchor, you'll find that anchors are often depicted with that tether winding down around the main axis of the anchor. Now, isn't that amazing? I mean, it's just exactly, it's a very, in a way, a very mundane, a very banal image. It's the image of the tattoo anchored on the shoulders of many sailors. Did I say the tattoo anchored on the shoulders? I mean the anchor tattooed on the shoulders of many sailors. Isn't it? And there you go. And already in that image, which is a cliche image of a sailor's tattoo, you have the image of the braid of pleuromic relay spirally winding down the anchor stem. Now, I find that absolutely astonishing. So, see how these visualizations work out and how spontaneous and playful they are. And how lucky are we to be able to observe the celestial anchor in the coming months and to contemplate it imaginatively, morally, dynamically, magically, at the same time that we see it before our eyes in the morning sky and earlier and earlier in the evening sky as the season proceeds from autumn into winter. So now what I'd like to do in completing this briefing is to tackle question of how celestial anchoring actually works. By celestial anchoring, by this metaphor, which is present to us as a celestial picture, we mean to establish a way to describe the function of pleuromic relay. The function. What does it accomplish? Well, it accomplishes her anchoring. But what is her anchoring? What does this mean? Now let's return to the scenario of conventional astronomy, okay? We understand that the Earth and the other planets don't travel in circular orbits around the sun. I mean, let's take the inaccurate conventional model of the solar system and beef it up a little bit here, okay? Planets, including the Earth, do not move in circular orbits around the sun. This is wrong on three counts. In the first place, no planet moves in an orbit around the sun. It is, in fact, the barycenter of each planet that orbits the sun. So it's not correct to say that the Earth orbits the sun. The point of the barycenter, which is within the Earth, is the point of mass that actually orbits the sun, carrying the Earth with it. Second error is that the orbits around the orbits of the planets around the sun are circular. They are not. They are elliptical. This goes back to Kepler. And I would point out that when Kepler worked out the math, and he did it with a pencil, and those penciled calculations were preserved, when he worked out the math, that he was able to develop by knowing the aphelion and perihelion points which he inferred from the observations of Tycho Brahe. All this is in the book The Sleepwalkers by Arthur Koestler, by the way. If you want some good fall and winter reading, read The Sleepwalkers by Arthur Koestler. When Kepler established through his calculations with a pencil that planetary orbits were elliptical, and he established the elliptical periods based on perihelion and aphelion points, he declared that he had rediscovered the secret of the Egyptian mysteries. So those of us in the Gaian mysteries today make a very clear point of remembering that the planetary orbits, including that of our beloved Earth, are elliptical and not circular. Finally, the third point of correction in the conventional astronomical scenario is that, of course, the planetary orbits are not circular or even elliptical, but they are ellipses that are extended into spirals as the Earth moves through space at 64,000 miles an hour, but entrained, presumably entrained, within the proper motion of the sun, which itself is moving through space in a particular direction, and therefore the planets circling the sun actually have their elliptical orbits extended into spiral lines. And this is something you can find illustrated on a YouTube clip by a popular guru named Nesim Harriman, who did not by any means discover this fact. It's obvious to any 12-year-old child who's presented with the facts of celestial mechanics. So there you go. And with that picture, we move now to the real wonder of Gaian celestial mechanics. And we integrate into that picture the fantastic prospect that the Earth is freeing itself from the capture of the planetary system. Now, the Earth, as it moves through space, the mothership, as she moves through the oceanic depths of the galactic limb, the galactic slipstream, is entrained and involved by two different extraterrestrial forces. One, of course, is the vortex power of the sun. So in some respect, the mothership moves within the wake or vortex of the mother's sun. Also, we know that she moves with a fleet of other ships simultaneously. And this is the archontic body of planetary vessels, the archontic body of vessels consisting of Mercury and Venus, which are within the sun, and Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, which are Mercury and Venus, which are between the sun and the Earth, and Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, which are beyond the orbit of the Earth, Saturn being the final and defining planet of the solar system, the trans-Saturnian planets, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, not being planets at all, but as it were, a kind of artificial probe attached to the solar system by the pleromic eons so that they can observe the experiment with special scrutiny. Now, in the Gaia navigation experiment, we hold to the premise that the Earth is freeing itself from the capture of the archontic planetary bodies. It is no longer a dumb material body compelled by the clockwork mechanics of the archontic planets. She, the mothership, becomes self-propelling and self-navigating. Bear in mind, we make a clear distinction between those two things. If you're riding a bicycle, you become self-propelling when you learn to pedal the bike, and you become self-navigating when you learn to steer the bike. These are completely different factors. Now, I'd like to remind you of a key proposition of the Gaian navigation experiment, which is the correction of Sophia takes place in the apsides of Jupiter. Now, you've seen so far already some illustration of this principle, and there is more to come, much more to come. I think you would all agree by now, all of those of you who are getting this experiment as it unfolds, that Jupiter, apart from being considered as one of the archontic planets, one of the planets in the archontic stereoma that Sophia allowed the archons to create as a habitat for themselves, Jupiter plays a preponderant role in correction. And the divine Sophia is using the forces of Jupiter to liberate herself into her corrective dynamics. It is no accident that Jupiter does a fantastically complex and non-linear tango dance with the apogee of the moon throughout correction. We've seen that tango dance happen as Jupiter glided from the fishes into the ram in the first half of correction, or of the establishing the initial conditions. We saw how Jupiter stood before the satanic mask of Cetus, which is just below the constellation of the ram, and made a retrograde loop there. And I indicated last year that in that function of its retrograde before the face of Cetus, Jupiter acted as the tug that swung the Earth around into her first position to assume self-navigation. Jupiter is tremendously important in Sophia's action to assume her own proper navigation. And in this action, she takes extreme and supreme care not to disturb the cargo of the planetary ark and not to cause harm to living beings in the habitat. She provides for them. And she actually uses Jupiter to do this. She can use Jupiter or anything else to do anything she wants. I've said this before. The only reason why the archonic planetary system exists is because she allowed the archons to, let's say, dupe themselves into thinking that they had the power to be godlike world creators. And she can take that power away from them just as quickly as she can grant it to them. And she is indeed doing this as I speak. The effects of her reclaiming that power or removing that power from the archons will be twofold. First of all, it will allow her as a planetary body to free herself from the capture of the archontic mechanics of the solar system and to navigate and power herself independently. And this is happening currently. This is the main event of the initial conditions of correction. Secondly, there will be a massive collective psychological release within the human species as she takes down the archontic power structure astronomically. As she takes it down astronomically, it comes down psychologically. Psyche and cosmos are mirrors of each other, and this is a principle you come to understand in Gnostic physics and in Gaian Tantra in a way that cannot be understood in any other system of physics or metaphysics. Which is to say, if I might add a few words of further clarification, that you come to understand it and to realize it both experimentally and actionally. Those members of the human species, those human animals dedicated to realize the anthropos in this experiment at its highest potential, all have similar and correlating experiences. This experiment is consistent and voracious. If it is done correctly, everyone participating in it will have basically the same experiences, but they'll have them autonomously. One of these experiences will be that you will detect and explore in your own psychic, emotional, and imaginative life a massive breakthrough into the sheer power of divine imagination. The second feature is that you will go actional with the realization of that power. And to go actional means to live from the power of divine imagination and to bring it into manifestation through moral and ethical activities. So this is the challenge and the beautiful possibility of living through this experiment at the level of success that we may now begin to imagine and share together and discuss among ourselves. And that is really something of the highest value, of the highest aspiration. So I would say that right now, living through this moment on Earth, what is the most exciting topic to be discussed? Well, among the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, there's absolutely no doubt about the answer to that question. The effects of pleromic relay. This is the most exciting subject to discuss. How is it going to work? How is it going to manifest? And how are we as individuals going to benefit from it? How's it going to change our lives? And how's it going to work its way through the human psyche into changes for the betterment of all living species? Simultaneously with those questions, which are selfish questions because they're about us, it would be well to ask what difference pleromic relay is making for the wisdom goddess, the divine Sophia, who is our planetary animal mother. And I want to conclude this briefing with some reflections on that aspect of the question, the great question of the moment. What does it actually mean? What does it entail dynamically for the planet Earth that some kind of celestial anchoring has now been fully established and is fully operational? How is she anchored? In what way is the mothership anchored? Well, she's not anchored in the sense of a ship at port that is anchored in one place without moving. Certainly not. She's not anchored in space. On the contrary, as the initial conditions of correction are established, she becomes capable of navigating freely and independently through space. The planet Earth is becoming capable of operating like a free-moving planet. And there are free-moving planets in the galactic limbs. There are planets, perhaps some which are even Earth-like planets, which are self-sustaining laboratories that move through space and travel through the galactic arms without being dynamically attached either to a moon or to another star, a sun. And this seems to be the evidence of science these days. These are called free-roaming planets. She's on the verge of becoming a free-roaming planet. She could potentially entirely depart from the solar system. So, she's not anchored in space, nor is she anchored in time. Her journey in time continues, and one day at a time for her is 26,000 years at a time. And each 26,000 years is one day of the divine experiment that she inaugurated in the Pleromic Center. But she is now involved intimately within that experiment in a way that no other aeon is involved or can be involved. And so her time now is free. Her time is her own, you could say. And she is not fettered or anchored in time. So in what sense is she anchored to the galactic core? What actually is being anchored? And what is the meaning of this anchoring? Well, bear in mind that a ship can be anchored while it continues on its course, that the anchor can be used as a device to help it stay its course when it's making a particular negotiation or navigation through a difficult passage or around a particular obstacle, or when it's assuming a course of navigation that will lead it into a very powerful current. At that point, the anchor could be deployed to help the vessel navigate. And I would guess that this is the case with the mothership right now, that Pleromic Relay is operational. Now, I would have you consider a curious nautical term. We do love these nautical terms, don't we? Because the nautical metaphor is our instrument for realizing the creative imagination, as Joseph Campbell predicted. The nautical metaphor, combined with the sacred narrative of the Divine Sophia, is the most powerful visionary instrument of which the human mind can conceive. So in the nautical metaphor, in the language of sailors, there's the term anchors away. It's a curious term because it can be spelled A-W-E-I-G-H or A-W-A-Y. And if you look up anchors away, try to find the original meaning of it, search it on the internet, you'll find that it's rather complicated and seems to have a number of meanings and not exactly clear what anchors away means. But I'm going to suggest to you the syntax of anchors away, A-W-A-Y, as an approach to what relay allows the mothership to do, as an approach to how relay functions. How does celestial anchor functioning? Well, in the first place, she anchors away. She doesn't anchor in the galactic stream. She anchors away from the galactic stream. In fact, two arms away at the galactic core. So the first thing to bear in mind, perhaps, is that the way she is anchored leaves her free in her course through the galactic arms, and yet connects her to the center of those spiraling arms. She anchors away from the center. Or, if you want to put it in another language, she anchors away from the third galactic arm where she is sailing into center. And you know, if you sail enough times around a galaxy, you eventually end up at the center. But you don't sail across the galactic arms transversely into the center. So let's get that visualization straight. On the journey of eternity, the mothership sails around and around the galactic arms. And each time she makes a full circle of her journey, she comes closer to reaching the galactic center. She sails up the third arm to the galactic center. and to steady her on that course, she anchors away. So that's one way to picture the celestial anchoring in the big framework, in the big perspective. Now let me suggest how to picture it in the perspective of your own life. There's a wonderful custom of indigenous people that I've observed over some years. It's most prominently seen in the Australian Aborigines and also the Native Americans, the Native American Indians. And this is the custom of naming a person by the first event that marks their perception of being alive, or by a striking event in childhood which decides the character and direction of that member of the tribe. So you'll find that traditionally in Native American societies, and I believe also to a certain extent this is true of the Australian Aborigines, that a person in the tribe doesn't acquire a name that is an habitual name like Susan or David or Kevin or Sebastian or Jonathan. No. Each member of the tribe acquires their name from a moment of signal perception. And a memorable instance of this, of course, occurs in the movie made by Kevin Costner called Dances with Wolves. Now, of course, when you first hear this movie, you think it means dances with wolves. Somebody went to some dances with wolves. But actually, when you see the story, you realize that it's not quite that way. The Lakota Sioux who befriend the character played by Kevin Costner don't know what to call him. And wisely, they don't call him by his white man's name, but they give him a name in the same way that they give the name to their own people. At one point in the movie, they saw him out in the field playing around with this young coyote who came to befriend him. And they see him approaching the coyote and then pulling away, and the coyote approaching him and pulling away. And to their perception, he was dancing with the wolf. And so, the coyote or the wolf, as you will. And so, when the moment came to give him a name, they called him Dances with Wolves. He's the one who dances with wolves. That's his name because it is the signal, because the name carries the meaning of the signal moment of his identity. The signal moment is when you perceive who you are and you act on it. Another example of this kind of naming comes from Japan in the samurai film Sanjuro by Akira Kurosawa. The hero, played by Toshiro Mifune, who was an early idol of mine, is a rogue samurai, and he comes into town and nobody knows his name. And when he's sitting down with some of the local people, they ask him his name. Well, of course, name means nothing to him because he lives in the void awareness of Buddhism, which was associated in certain respects with the samurai warrior lifestyle. And he doesn't care what you call him, but they're asking him for his name. And he's sitting there with them in a typical Japanese country house, and the sliding door is open, looking out onto a field, which I believe is a field of barley. And I believe that Sanjuro is the Japanese word for barley. And so when they ask him what is his name, the first thing that he does is glance to that field, and the first thing that he sees is barley. So he says his name is Sanjuro. So this is a wonderful example. I might not have the translation exact there, but you get the point. It's a wonderful example of the same thing illustrated in Dances with Wolves. So I'm here to say that all of you now, all of you including me, have a name to bestow on ourselves. A at this moment. And that name comes to us from the cosmos. It comes for us from the signal perception that we have each individually as we interact with the cosmos right now. In the abstract, I could say that celestial anchoring does not anchor the mothership in space, nor does it anchor her in time, but it anchors her on her way, steady as she goes. It anchors her on her course through the galactic limb. It anchors her way. And if we perceive this, if we live with her in this fantastic and incomparable moment, then we are those who may take the name Anchors Her Way. And that name belongs to every single one of us in this experiment. Every faithful observer, every dedicated crew member has the same name. And if you would ask yourself how, microcosmically, how do you anchor her way so that you deserve that name? Well, the answer is very, very simple. You anchor her way by anchoring her story in your life story. Every single individual who anchors her story in their life transcends their life. And everyone who does that can be called Anchors Her Way. So it's not only the aeons in the galactic Pleroma who anchor her way. They certainly do that in the vast cosmic perspective. But what she needs, in addition to proof of love, is the human presence that steadies her way and anchors her on her course in the experiment she devised for those human animals. And that is all you have to know, and all you need to know. As Keats once said, beauty is truth, and truth is beauty. That is all you know on earth, and all you need to know.